The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're taking a closer look at the pharmaceutical industry, where state-of-the-art medicine is sometimes supported by less-than-stellar science. A little later on, we're joined by Dr. Stephen Novella to discuss the pitfalls of using animals to stand in for humans in medical testing. But first, let's talk about the science supporting prescription drugs and how it doesn't always live up to the hype. I'm joined by Dr. Ben Goldacre. Ben is an award-winning science writer, the author of the Guardian newspaper's Bad Science column, and the book of the same name. He's here to talk to us about his new book, Bad Pharma: How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So before we get into the meat of it all, I do want to ask about the reception to your book. What's the response been like?
Well, you know, if you write a book about problems in medicine and criticize a $700 billion global industry and also regulators and doctors and academics for sort of acquiescing or being unambitious about fixing big important problems, some people will have tantrums, of course. And they've been really interesting, actually. It came out in the UK a few months before in the US. And in the UK, there's been a trajectory of initially very sort of colourful, lurid denunciations and smears from the ABPI, which is the UK pharma industry body. And they issued this absurd, outright denial. They said that all of the issues raised in the book were historic and that they had all been long addressed. Which, to me, sort of shows that the utterances of the ABPI and Stephen Whitehead, the president of the ABPI, are about what they think or hope they can get away with rather than what's true. Because the book is it's a long and detailed, technical, quite nerdy discussion of shortcomings in medicine. It's not a self-help book. It's not a conspiracy theory book. It doesn't say everything is completely broken and medicines kill you. It says there are interesting technical flaws in the way that we measure the relative benefits of different treatments, and many of these could be improved on, and a lot of them are driven by industry. And to issue such a childish blanket denial seemed amazing to me. Anyway, so it's just come out in America, and Pharma, the US industry body, has kind of issued a very similar sort of colourful denunciation and outright denial. It's interesting to see the differences between the two territories, actually, and what rhetorically they think will play.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
In England, people have tried to pretend that the problem of clinical trial results being withheld simply doesn't happen. Now, the best currently available evidence shows that half of all the clinical trials that are conducted and completed haven't been published for the medicines that we use today, and that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published when compared with trials with negative results. And that's a problem, you know, for industry and for independent academic research. What's weird is the American sort of industry response has basically been to say it's okay for us to withhold evidence from doctors and patients because industry being able to make money and invent new drugs is really important, and anything that shackles that is bad. And actually, I agree that that stuff is very important. It's just surprising to see a casual assumption that it can be more important than having all of the evidence available to make informed decisions about patient care on things that really matter.
I think maybe we need to step back just one step.
So just so that people are kind of oriented, for an overview of the book, or rather the problems that I'm interested in, we like to imagine we have this kind of caricaturish fantasy that evidence-based medicine is all about people making informed decisions on the basis of randomized controlled trials, which we hope are fair tests of which treatment is best when two are compared. And that's not quite true, and I've written about the shortcomings in those systems. So firstly, randomized controlled trials aren't all necessarily fair tests. Some of them can be flawed by design in lots of really interesting, nerdy ways. And to be fair, like, part of my motivation for writing the book was I love the game of design flaws in clinical trials, and I just really wanted to talk about that. Then secondly, the problem is that we don't see the results of all of those clinical trials. So as I said, half of all the trials for the treatments we use today have never been published, and that's the best currently available estimate from the most current systematic review, which is only 2 years old. And then finally, what we see is biased disseminations. We're not very good in medicine at systems to get evidence to doctors and patients to make decisions. A lot of the time, information is got to doctors through marketing. And I'm actually pretty relaxed about marketing in medicine in the sense that I don't think it's the most important problem. I think it's an inevitability that people will want to market medicines. And also, I think a good doctor will basically ignore biased dissemination of evidence through advertising, industry-sponsored teaching, and so on. So unlike missing data, it doesn't pollute the well for everybody. It just pollutes the well for rubbish, lazy doctors. But at the same time, it's useful just to have an overview for clinicians and patients of the current state of the evidence on the problems with biased dissemination of medical evidence through marketing.
So when you say that there is missing data, where is this data, sir?
So a company or a researcher does a randomized controlled trial. It comes to the end, you analyze the data, and then you get to choose whether you publish it in a journal or not. For the most part, you have to give it to regulators, although the legislation on that depends on different territories, whether it's a licensed use or not. So, you know, there are different extents to which regulators will have that evidence. Also, they don't necessarily retain it. But when you do a trial, the bottom line is you don't have to share it with doctors and patients, the people who make decisions about which treatment to use.
So you can do as many trials as you want, and they can all show no statistical significance, and then let's say the 26th trial, you see some. That's fine.
That's exactly correct. Yeah, that would be very, very extreme to have 25 right. negative trials and one positive one. But yeah, I mean, that's basically the problem. And this isn't, let's remember, about drugs being completely useless. I think it's actually fairly unusual that drugs get on the market which are entirely useless or do more harm than good. It's about whether we have access to all of the information to make an informed decision about the trade-off between the risks and the benefits, but also about the trade-off between different treatments to decide which is the best. That's a really interesting quirk of the problem. Firstly, in terms of popular discourse, it's hilarious sort of going around talking to mainstream media in America at the moment about this, because they kind of go, so you're saying these drugs kill us? And you go, no, I'm saying we don't know which is the best, and that means there are serious implications for cost effect. And they kind of, you can see them glazing over and going, aren't boring.
Oh.
But actually, that's really important, okay, because not knowing which treatment is best because the evidence is polluted and obfuscated and half missing results in pain, suffering, and death in exactly the same way as actually harming people with treatments. Let's imagine, you know, you've got one treatment that will save 8 lives out of 100 and one treatment that will only save 6 lives out of 100. Well, if you can make the second best treatment look like it's the best through a combination of flawed trial design, aggressive marketing, and withholding unflattering results, if you can get doctors and patients to use your treatment that only saves 6 lives out of 100 instead of the one that would have saved 8 lives out of 100, then you are costing lives. And I think what's interesting about that is it's kind of how everybody's let themselves off the hook of worrying about this problem. And it's kind of how industry has allowed itself, I think, to sort of feel good and okay about pushing third best drugs that are the third best in class, you know, because pretty much everything we do in medicine does do some good. But if by your actions, your desire to sell your products or your idea, you get people to take your treatment at the expense of a better treatment, then you are depriving people of that better treatment. You are imposing avoidable suffering and harm and sometimes death on patients. And I don't understand why that is difficult for people to understand. I don't understand why it's difficult for industry to understand that. And also, I can sort of, to a greater extent, understand why for talk radio hosts, it's a little bit more of a challenge than, oh my God, drugs are killers. But, you know, I think this is important and interesting stuff. So 25 negative trials and one positive one would be fairly unusual, but actually much more common is 7 positive and 3 negative, and only the positive ones get published or whatever.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Dr. Ben Goldacre about his book, Bad Pharma, How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. So isn't somebody supposed to be looking out for these kind of things, a regulator perhaps?
Regulators have really dropped the ball on this in really interesting ways. So firstly, there are lots of regulations and codes of conduct that are supposed to fix it, but which simply haven't been enforced and have delivered only false reassurance. So International Committee of Medical Journal Editors in 2005 said, we have the ultimate carrot. Everybody, if they get a positive result, wants to publish it in one of our academic journals. So we will only allow you to publish results in our journals if you've registered your trial on a publicly accessible register. And the idea of that was, at least if you force researchers to post trials in progress on a register, then you can go back and see if there are any that have been conducted and completed but not published. So the idea was this had fixed everything forever because now everything was going to be registered. And everybody assumed that it had worked. There was no routine public audit. In 2010, we discovered that half of all trials published in the top 10 academic journals in the big five fields of medicine, half of those trials weren't properly registered, a quarter of them weren't registered at all. So that failed. Then secondly, there's some legislation. For example, FDA Amendment Act 2007 is the thing that everybody loves to cite at parties. That's the one that says you have to post results of your clinical trial within 1 year of completion on a website called clinicaltrials.gov. It doesn't cover all trials. It only covers trials with at least one site in the US or that are being used as part of a marketing authorization in the US to get a new drug approved for use. And everybody said once again, oh, fantastic, the problem's been fixed. Again, no routine public audit. When one was finally published in the British Medical Journal just last year, 2012, it found that the rate of compliance with this law was 22%. So 4 out of 5 trials ignored this legislation. There's a $10,000 a day fine for breaking that law, but no fine has ever been levied by the FDA, despite the abysmally low level of compliance. And, you know, even if one had been, $10,000 a day is a lot of money to you or me, but $3.5 million a year to a company that's marketing a blockbuster is basically a parking ticket. So there are regulations and they failed. But the thing that's more interesting, I think, is the kind of culture of regulators. They've got a slightly sort of paternalistic view of doctors, I think. So regulators have this idea that, hey, we see most of this data behind closed doors, and we make the decisions about whether treatments work or not, and that should be okay. Roche recently have tried to make this argument themselves about releasing Tamiflu data. Firstly, I think that's a very old-fashioned paternalistic notion because it's a sort of doctor knows best mentality, but it's regulators speaking to doctors in the way that doctors used to speak to patients in the 50s. You know, oh, I know best, just shut up and use this. Secondly, regulators often get things wrong, and that's not because they're stupid. It's because these are very difficult issues, scientifically speaking. So if you think of the big scandals of medicine of the past few years, like, I don't know, Vioxx, Avandia, Tamiflu, none of those problems were spotted by regulators. They were spotted by independent researchers and academics who'd managed to get hold of data through various different means. So I'm not saying that regulators miss that because they're stupid. It's more that these are difficult problems, and difficult problems benefit from many eyes. And that's why it's good for everyone to have access.
But there's another aspect of this, because it isn't just the pharmaceutical companies that are withholding data. Regulators are often withholding data as well, and specifically saying that they can't share data because of the commercial interests that must be protected.
That's right. So this is particularly an issue for getting hold of full clinical study reports, which are the very long, detailed documents that describe all of the kind of methodological design quirks of a clinical trial, and which often, we're just very recently starting to learn over the past few years, which often reveal that the brief summaries of what happened in a clinical trial, in, for example, the very, very scanty summaries that you get off regulators where they do release information, but also the brief summary that you see in a 6-page academic journal article about a trial, can often be incomplete, misleading, or inaccurate. And increasingly, researchers at, for example, Cochrane, which is the global non-profit academic collaboration of 15,000 academics who make gold standard summaries of all of the evidence on important questions in medicine about which treatment works best. Increasingly, the people from Cochrane are realizing that we need to start working from these clinical study reports. If not routinely, then at least in areas where there are sort of doubts about how well a trial was conducted. And trying to get hold of these has proved pretty difficult. The European Medicines Agency will now release the CSRs, the clinical study reports that they have. Now, they don't have them going back very far because the European Medicines Agency hasn't existed in its current role for more than a couple of years. But they do have some clinical study reports which they're releasing. And as I say in the book, you know, they release them now and they sort of act as if they should be awarded a point for how wonderful and transparent they're being. But in reality, they only released them because they were forced in 2011 to do so by one of the most damning findings of maladministration by the European Ombudsman that has ever been delivered against an institution in Europe. They were found guilty of making misleading statements about why they were withholding these clinical study reports from Cochrane. The Ombudsman found that their brief summaries of clinical trials were misleading and inaccurate. It was, you know, it was a real bloodbath of a ruling. And what was striking about it was the lengths that the regulator had gone to try and justify withholding information from doctors. And the arguments that they used that just seemed to betray an extraordinary lack of insight into the importance of their role. Because they were talking, as you said, about how this information contained commercially confidential information. These clinical study reports contain commercially confidential information, which is just simply, well, you know, if you find out that a treatment doesn't work so great and people are going to stop using it, that has a commercial impact. But the extent to which it's commercially confidential can only be sort of seriously interpreted in terms of whether it's proportional to the harm done to patients by them not knowing what the true effects of the treatment that they get are. And the thing that I find baffling about all of that really is, you know, why does science have any credibility at all? Why does science have any authority? It's not because we wear white coats or have letters after our name. It's because of the transparency. It's because we are clear about the precise methods of the experiment that we did, and we are clear about the results that we got. And then everybody can have a serious conversation about whether they think those methods and those results justify our conclusions and our practices in medicine. And the secrecy of regulators and of industry go completely against those principles. It's anti-scientific, and it's anti-scientific in exactly the same sense that quackery can be. But it's just anti-scientific in a slightly more sophisticated and interesting way than quackery is. It's like the postgraduate version of bad science. You know, the Royal Society above its doors has this chipped out Latin motto, which is nullius in verba, on the word of no one. And that is, you know, that's science, on the word of no one. You know, it's not about somebody saying, use this, it works. It's about someone saying, I did this experiment, I got this result. That's why I think you might agree with me that you should use this and that it works. And regulators have failed to grok that. And as a society, it's bizarre to me that we've tolerated this. And actually, well, you know, as I say in the book, the people that I'm most disappointed with actually aren't the drug companies. It's senior academic and medical professional bodies and regulators, who are the people who were entitled to have sort of higher expectations of. They've sort of failed to live up to not just our expectations, but they failed to come anywhere near to doing what we traditionally would assume that they would do. And that's baffling. Well, it's not baffling. There are all kinds of interesting cultural and political reasons why it happens, but it's pretty disappointing to a reasonably young doctor.
We'll be back with more talk of bad pharma with Dr. Ben Goldacre right after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell. My guest is Dr. Ben Goldacre, a science writer who focuses on unpacking the evidence behind misleading claims from journalists, the pharmaceutical industry, alternative therapists, and government reports. He's made a number of documentaries for BBC Radio 4, and he's written the Bad Science column in The Guardian since 2003. His new book is Bad Pharma. How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. You do actually provide some remedies, quite a few remedies actually, throughout the book. Specifically in regards to these kind of issues, you're talking about calling for bigger, simpler trials.
Yeah, so that's kind of a separate issue actually. But yeah, I mean, throughout the whole book, I explain the very sort of simple policy initiatives that would fix these problems. And I don't think they come at any financial cost. And actually, I don't think they come at that much of a cost to industry. I don't think industry benefits from competing across terrain that rewards obfuscation on evidence. And I'm amazed that they are so stupid and short-sighted that they don't recognize that. I mean, if they had any sense, they would say, yeah, you're right. Actually, if we all had to compete on being transparent and giving clear information, then we wouldn't have such a bad reputation. Because it's bizarre that drug companies who make these life-saving, fantastic products, because at the final furlong, they managed to sort of distort all the evidence and mislead people, they have an amazingly bad reputation. You know, to throw away what should be the best reputation anywhere in all of the industries and turn that into being the dodgiest possible is extraordinary. But you asked about bigger, simpler trials, which I think is...
Specifically, though, I'm wondering about, you outlined sort of a structure that actually already exists in Britain that would work for bigger, simpler trials, the GP research database. I thought that was a really interesting idea.
When I talk about the design flaws in trials in the book, you know, drugs and all treatments tend to be tested in ideal patients who are much more likely to get better, so younger, healthier, fewer other medicines, fewer other diagnoses, because that's much quicker and easier to demonstrate that your treatment works. I talk about shortcomings in research, like that we often tend to measure surrogate outcomes, like blood tests, rather than real-world outcomes, like pain, suffering, and death, not to put too fine a point on it. And a lot of these shortcomings in trial design come about because it makes a trial quicker and easier and cheaper to do it that way. It also exaggerates benefits often, but more than that, it's about saving money. And we've made trials, I think, unnecessarily bureaucratic and expensive, especially when it comes to comparing treatments which are currently in use. The really important issue in medicine now is, out of all the treatments we have to lower cholesterol, prevent heart attacks and strokes, lower blood pressure and so on, which is the best? And industry often shies away from that, but it's very, very easy for us to fix the problem of them not wanting to run those trials ourselves, by which I mean it's very easy for us to just run big, simple trials ourselves in routine clinical care. So as an example of that, I just describe one project that I'm involved in the UK, which is a very, very cheap trial to compare two statins against each other. So this kind of encapsulates a lot of the problems and shortcomings in medical research. You can see, like, you can imagine, like, local radio DJ's eyes glozing over when I go anywhere near discussing anything
this
like this.
This is a nerdy show, sir. Bring it.
We don't know which statin is best, right? We know that statins work overall. You know, all the statins have been compared against dummy placebo sugar pills and shown to reduce heart attacks and death. All of the statins have been compared against each other to see which is best at lowering cholesterol, and they're all fairly much equally effective, depending on dose. But nobody's ever done a trial comparing statins against each other to see which is best at preventing heart attack and death. And actually, sometimes drugs which are equivalent on changing a surrogate process outcome, like a blood test for cholesterol or your blood pressure, drugs which are just as good as each other at achieving those surrogate outcomes can be wildly different in the impact they have on real-world outcomes like death. So the problem with doing a head-to-head trial on whether something prevents death several years down the road is the problem that almost all medical research and epidemiology faces, which is people take a really long time to die. Like, it's a really annoying frustration. So because of that, you want to think, where can I follow people up for a long time for free? So our project is very simple. Basically, there's a thing called the GP Research Database, 3 million people's electronic health records, just from their normal family doctor's notes on them. And it's already used for research in the UK, for observational research, where you look at people's medical records. But what you really want is to do randomized trials embedded in that data set, because randomized trials mean that you can account for any alternative explanations about why people on one drug might be apparently doing better, because the people that are getting one drug or another drug may not be completely comparable. So in our trial, pretty much everybody where the doctor ever tries to prescribe them a statin, essentially a big red screen flashes up and goes, wait, we don't know which of the two most commonly used statins is the best. Press this big red button here to randomly assign your patient to one or the other, and you'll never have to think about it ever again. We'll collect all the follow-up data from the computer system. And that addresses many of the barriers to doing research.
Exactly.
Because it firstly means there's no extra administrative effort for the doctor or for the patient. You're not saying come in for a blood test at 3 weeks and then every 4 months, because you just snatch the cholesterol readings that people are having just in the course of their normal clinical care out of the system. If they go into hospital with a heart attack, you can get that from hospital episode statistics linked to their GPRD data. If they die, you can get that from ONS, and so on. If they, you know, and also actually very good at spotting, well, potentially an interesting and different and possibly better way of spotting side effects. So that's the project. It's like for £500,000, you can follow up thousands of people on one statin or another pretty much forever and do a trial which, if you did it the traditional way, would cost tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm kind of sad that we're not better at embedding real-world outcomes research like that in routine clinical care all of the time. I mean, I you know, in the book there is this kind of rather dewy-eyed manifesto, cri de coeur, for us to turn all health systems into these completely optimized systems for exploiting every situation where there, wherever there's reasonable uncertainty about which treatment is best, and turning that into evidence. Because, you know, from a public health perspective, it's absolutely senseless that we tolerate unnecessary uncertainty about which treatment is best. We should be religiously on the lookout for every situation where a doctor is having to make a decision without good evidence. And wherever that situation occurs, we should at least be offering to the doctor and the patient the opportunity to be randomized between one of two currently used treatments. And remember, this isn't about, I'm not proposing this for experimental new cancer drugs. I'm talking about things like which of these statins is the best when we know that they're both safe, effective, used by tens of millions of people around the world. And we have to remember, when you look at something like statins and heart attack, if one statin turned out to be only 1 or 2% better than the other, then that would actually have quite serious implications for public health, because statins are taken by huge numbers of people around the world, and heart attack is a very common cause of death. But the same is true for most treatment guidelines for most common and uncommon diseases. When you get to the third or fourth point on the decision tree in a treatment guideline, say for asthma, if you don't get better on the first three drugs, the map of medicine, the treatment guidelines by the time you get to the third or fourth step, are often based on expert opinion rather than randomized trials. And there's no need for that. We should be religiously identifying uncertainty and running trials everywhere we can. And trials shouldn't be the exception. There shouldn't be some esoteric, expensive project that can only be done by industry. You know, that's the world of pen and paper and clerks doing maths by hand to calculate the benefits of treatment. Now that we have computerized records, now that we have huge numbers of people going through the same administrative systems in healthcare, then it should be a trivial matter for us to be constantly improving medical knowledge. And actually that's kind of my mission objective on all of this. It's not industry is bad, stop them doing bad things. It's industry doesn't gather evidence and disseminate it in a particularly brilliant or perfect way. Let's just do it better and cheaper ourselves. And that goes for doing trials and ensuring that they're all published, but it also goes for dissemination of evidence. You know, like I said, I'm not that bothered about marketing. I don't think it's very stylish if doctors accept industry-funded teaching, but I'm not going to lose sleep over it. I just think they should be aware of the risks, and we should teach them the risks in medical school. But actually, more than that, I think that health insurers and and governments who pay for healthcare should be much more alive to the realities of how doctors find out about which treatment is best, how they make decisions, and invest as much in infrastructure for disseminating evidence to clinicians as we do in infrastructure for hospitals or computing or sharing x-rays between different sites and different units in a hospital. The information architecture of evidence-based medicine has been allowed to grow in a very ad hoc, creaky fashion from very outdated legacy ways of doing things, mostly built around sort of word-of-mouth oral traditions and 19th century essays in peer-reviewed academic journals. And I don't think we should settle for that. That's the story which I've been trying to tell local radio people who introduce you by going, hey, here's the guy who reckons like all drugs are rubbish.
Ben, that was wonderful. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for your time. Cheers.
You'll find links to Dr. Ben Goldacre and his book, Bad Pharma, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Now, I just spoke with Ben Goldacre about all the problems around pharmaceutical regulation, which are legion, apparently. But what we didn't get into was all the places that this could go wrong before we even get anywhere near the regulatory phase. So we already know that there are tons of ways that experiments can be botched. We've talked at length on this show about small sample sizes and other design flaws, but there's one that we haven't touched on, and it's recently made the news. The utility of using animal models in biomedical research. With me is Dr. Stephen Novella. Steve is a clinical neurologist and assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine. He also writes for the Science-Based Medicine website, hosts the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and does so many other things that people think he might actually be a robot. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks for having me, Desiree.
So a study just came out that looked at the standard mouse model of sepsis, trauma, and infection, and it appears that maybe using mice wasn't the best idea. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, essentially researchers were looking at the mouse models that are used for major inflammatory disorders, especially inflammation in response to severe stress, like sepsis, which is a blood infection, or trauma. And they looked at the genes that get activated in humans in those situations, and their research was criticized for not comparing it to or backing it up with an animal model of the same situation. So they said, okay, they went back, they got the mouse model data, and what they found, to their surprise, was that a completely different set of genes was being activated in mice during these same situations, sepsis and trauma. So digging a little bit deeper, what they eventually discovered was that the mouse immune system just behaves really differently from the human immune system, and that therefore prior research based upon the mouse model of the immune system may not be very predictive of what interventions, such as drugs, are likely to work in humans. And in fact, the track record is pretty poor in terms of candidate drugs that look promising in the mouse model not panning out when applied to humans.
So why were mice used in the first place for these experiments?
Because they're little and convenient, and we have lots of different breeds of mice, and we know a lot about mice, and they're a good first approximation of a vertebrate mammalian, you know, biology, physiological system. So it's perfectly reasonable to start with mice in looking to create an animal model of a human disease or a human system. And this is just the science of the technology of science itself. And this is really nothing new or scandalous or anything. Scientists understand that animal models are imperfect, that they are just an approximation of what's happening in people, and that they're used as a convenience. And scientists also understand that they have to calibrate or assess the animal models that they use to see how good they are and if they're useful at all, and also that mice may not be the best animal for everything when studying human disease. Sometimes guinea pigs are better, sometimes rabbits are better, sometimes monkeys are better. So this is always a standing question. How good's the animal model? Do you have an animal model? You know, is it a good analogy? Where does it break down? This was maybe a little surprising in that something that was used for a while, there's a major new piece of information showing that for the immune system response to major stress, the mouse model is probably really crappy. And that definitely will be a lesson going forward in terms of future research.
Well, from the researchers that I've spoken to, these researchers weren't the first to bring this up as a concern in the first place.
No, that's right. And I was writing about this. I looked at, I just did a literature search just to see what people had been saying over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years about the animal model of sepsis, because the news reporting of this, they always make it seem more dramatic than it is. Oh, this comes out of the blue and changes everything we thought we knew. They always, you know, that's, those are always the terms in which these news stories are presented. But if you did a, you know, do a literature search, and I've also, you know, spoken to infectious disease specialists, they're like, yeah, this is old news. You know, this is what people have been talking about for years, that the mouse model is not great for these conditions. This, I think, just told us exactly why it's not great, because they just, the genetics of the mouse immune system behave differently than the genetics of the human immune system, because the, you know, the evolutionary pressures on mice were different than humans, and so it's just, it departed sufficiently from the human immune system in evolutionary time that it just no longer is a good an analog of human immunity.
What does this mean then? Does this mean that all the research on mice that's been done in these areas is flawed?
Yeah, I would say flawed. Again, all animal research, all animal models of human disease are limited, and, you know, flawed. And I'm not sure if that's the proper word, perhaps, but it's extremely limited. This is, I think, more limited than we even realized. And again, tells us exactly why it probably could be, is in fact could be misleading. So that's always the question. You know, again, is how predictive is the animal model? And again, you know, this is something like on science-based medicine that we've been saying for years. You can't make clinical claims based upon preclinical evidence, including animal models. The only purpose of animal models is either to help us understand basic physiology and biology, or to give us some predictive value in terms of whether or not we should invest in human trials or not. And sometimes people fall into the Nirvana fallacy of saying that, well, there's all these limitations on the animal model. It's not perfect. Therefore, it's useless. Like, well, no, it could be imperfect and limited as long as you kind of understand that, but still be better than nothing. And before you do human research where you're giving people experimental drugs, we want as much information as possible, even if that information is imperfect, just so that the resources and the risk, everything is optimized as much as possible. But it's never, ever a substitute for human data.
So this sounds more that like it was a massive waste of time for people more than it actually did damage then.
It may have, well, yeah, I think it did damage in that it may have led to human trials based upon the animal model that was not predictive or that was misleading. Studies that would not have been done had we known, you know, that there was this disconnect between the mouse immune system and the human immune system. But yeah, that's wasted resources, but some of those resources are people, you know, that's not a minor thing. You know, subjecting a human being to an experimental drug, it's our duty to do everything we can to make sure that it has the best chance of helping them and not hurting them. And we do rely upon animal models to optimize that chance.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with more of Dr. Stephen Novella on using animal models in scientific tests after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at what science has to say about the origins of selfless and even self-sacrificing behavior. We'll speak to biology professor Lee Allen Dugatkin about his book, The Altruism Equation, Seven Scientists Search for the Origins of Goodness. And we'll discuss altruism from a neurological perspective with Dr. James Doty, professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Stanford University and the director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Stephen Novella, clinical neurologist and assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine, and host of the popular podcast, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Now, you mentioned this, not only previously in this conversation, but also in your post on science-based medicine on this. You say that the research calling the mouse model into question was actually a positive development. How so?
Well, now we understand more about the mouse immune system, and also this same research, this flowed out of research that was teaching us about the human immune system. We understand more about which genes are activated, which proteins are involved, and you know why the immune system responds the way it does. This is adding to our knowledge base. So yeah, that's always a positive development, absolutely.
But you also pointed out that the media did not exactly present it that way.
Yeah, well, the media loves certain narratives, you know, that they go back to. Every scientific discovery is a breakthrough, you know. Everything has to relate to some specific application, and there's a few go-to applications in medicine. You know, anything to do with the immune system is always going to be a cure for cancer or a cure for the common cold. You know, anything to do with the virus, right, is a cure for the common cold. So these narratives keep cropping up over and over again in the media. And here we have scientists were completely wrong, and now they're shocked and stunned at how overturned their knowledge was, and you know that's just news reporting of science. That's par for the course. But the truth is always more complicated, always more nuanced, always more subtle. This is an incremental advance. It's important. It's a good advance. The research seems solid. This definitely will inform our research technology going forward. But this was not, you know, the stunning overturning of established science that the media was making out to be. And I don't want to entirely blame them either. You know, I never know when I read these stories and I hear scientists being quoted. I never know, was this researchers puffing up the implications of their own research? Which, let's face it, you know, researchers do that. We're humans. Everyone wants their research to be important. Or was it the media cherry picking, or maybe, you know, really digging for quotes from researchers and taking them out of context? Sometimes the reporters write the story first and then mine the quotes later. Or was it a collaboration? Did the researchers oversell their research and the media really ran with that interpretation? It's probably where the truth is, somewhere in between. So, you know, I'm not trying to, researchers are not innocent in all this. I'm not trying to just blame journalists. It's a combination. Scientists have to learn how to talk to journalists. Journalists need to understand how science works, and I do wish they would get away from these tired, cliched narratives that they write over and over and over again.
Well, now I'm curious. How would you have liked to have seen that presented then?
Well, you know, if you have a scientifically savvy journalist, which I think a science journalist should be, they could have done what I did. Go on PubMed and type in sepsis and animal model or whatever, and you get read the last 10 things that have been published, and you'll see that everyone was calling this model into question. This didn't come out of the blue. These weren't the first researchers to bring up this idea. The other thing that they could do is, you know, talk to and journalists, good journalists often do this, is talk to researchers who are not involved with the study that you're reporting on. And just to see what somebody else thinks about it. Are these guys in the mainstream? Are they out on the fringe? Are they overselling their point of view? Is there another, you know, valid or legitimate point of view that they're not, that they're underplaying or not telling me about? That's just doing journalism, but within the context of science. You know, I think that's what good science bloggers do. That's what good science journalists do, but often it's missing from the science stories that we see in the media.
Now, how common is this exactly, that we find out that we were using the wrong animal all along?
I don't know if I can't give you any statistics. I mean, I think it's every time I read about an animal model of research, there's always either the explicit or implicit question of how good is the animal model? That's something that scientists are constantly racking their brains about. Like, for example, I've done a little ALS research, and you know, it's interesting to sit in a room with ALS researchers and talking about, well, how good is the SOD1 mutation model, you know, animal model of ALS? Does it predict future clinical research in humans. It does in some cases, it doesn't in others. Should we abandon it? Should we use a different model to assay our drugs and decide which ones to test in people? This is always an open, ongoing question, and it's not black or white, like the model's perfect or it's horrible. It's usually somewhere in between. So I just see all animal models as imperfect, and you know, we need to always have an assessment of how useful they are. And every animal model for every disease is different. It's all case by case. You can't make sweeping statements about animal models. Some animal models are great. They really are very highly predictive. They're a good model of the disease that we're studying, and they're highly predictive of human research, and others are terrible, as long as we understand where we are.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, how would a researcher know if they were using the wrong animal models?
So there's a couple ways you can evaluate the validity of an animal model that you have. One is to say, well, is the underlying biology in this animal the same as it is in humans? And that's essentially what these researchers were doing. They were looking at the genetic activation, you know, in these conditions. But I think the ultimate test is, and this is something that you can only figure out after decades of research, is when we do drug research, let's say drug development using this animal model, and this like drug A appears to work in our animal model, this animal model of disease X, how often does that predict the outcome of human research? But then you need 10, 20, 30, I don't know, how many times do you have to do that before you could begin to understand how predictive the animal model is? You're talking decades of research,
right,
of animal research translating into human research. Eventually you look back and go, gee, the last 30 drugs that looked really good in our mouse model, not one of them panned out in the human research. Maybe this animal model isn't so good. Or, you know, we're running 40-50% hit rate, you know, off of our animal model. This is great. You know, we're going to continue to use this to screen drugs. But that takes a long time to figure that out.
Well, if someone was able to actually notice something off, let's say, would there be pushback from other people that use those animal models in their own research?
There's always a certain amount of pushback just because scientists are appropriately skeptical and no one piece of data is definitive. And when you have conflicting data, people are going to ask skeptical questions, and that's always interpreted as pushback, but it's legitimate. The question is, that I think you're asking, and this is what, you know, again, was the implication in the way this story was reported, was that there was inappropriate pushback,
right,
that there was pushback above and beyond just the normal, appropriate, healthy level of skepticism that scientists are supposed to display towards new ideas or to any one study. But I don't see that. I think just above and beyond sort of the baseline personalities of scientists, I don't think there was like any big resistance or conspiracy against this idea. I think, again, that's one of the narratives that journalists love that's really just overplayed and is just not that true most of the time. It's you have a spectrum of opinions, and that spectrum migrates over to the evidence over time, and it seems to follow, and you know, whenever we sort of dig deep on these questions, it seems the evidence actually seems to support the notion that the scientists are pretty adaptive to moving towards the evidence over time. The big one that everyone, that sort of the go-to example of this, was the H. pylori for gastric ulcers. You know, the notion in the 70s and then 80s that that a bacteria, H. pylori, was causing gastric ulcers, not stress. The community resisted this new notion. But if you look at the number of papers that were published exploring the idea that H. pylori causes ulcers, it increased steadily throughout the 20 years period that the media was saying that there was this conspiracy of pushback against the idea. The evidence doesn't support that narrative. It supports as the data came in positive, more people started studying it until it eventually reached critical mass, and then people accepted the idea. It followed the exact curve of the evidence that you would expect.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Novella, clinical neurologist and assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine. So there are standard animal models that we use for specific kinds of research on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah. The search for a good animal model is always huge. It's always ongoing. And Often, you know, researchers will expend a lot of resources doing that, because once you have an animal model and it is a good animal model, then that accelerates all subsequent research. So there are animal models for tons of things, many genetic diseases. You know, we will do what's called a knockout. You know, just will either take out or damage or whatever, and put the same mutation and the same gene in the mouse, and there you go. You have an instant animal model of the human disease. Then you just have to figure out how good the that animal model is of the human disease. You know, it's always good if you can create the condition, you know, in the animal. So, for example, there's experimental allergic encephalitis in mice, and that is the animal model of multiple sclerosis. You know, we can't wait for mice to just spontaneously develop MS in the same way that people do. We have to give them the equivalent of MS. So, we, you know, they have a procedure where they can, you know, inject mice with the proper things, and it produces this condition. And we know it's not MS. It's not multiple sclerosis. But it's pretty similar. It's inflammation in the nervous system. Okay, that's pretty good. Let's see if we could, you know, interfere with that. And we know it's not perfect, but again, it's certainly better than having no knowledge at all about what kind of effects drugs have on inflammation in the nervous system.
So what animals are we using right now for neurological studies?
Well, again, it depends on the condition, depends on the disease. Mice are always the most common just because they're convenient, and we have lots of breeds of mice, you know, that are useful for lots of different things. But you will see everything. You know, you will see guinea pigs and rabbits, and if we need something a little bit closer to humans, because, you know, usually for central nervous system things, like if you're studying the brain, mm-hmm. you pretty much have to go to primates. If you need to have brains that look a lot like human brains, and they do. It's really interesting. Somebody played a trick on me once. They threw up an MRI scan of a brain and said, "What do you think about this, Steve?" So, you know, I'm reading it, and it's like, there's just something off about this brain. All the pieces were there. All the anatomical structures were there. Everything was in the right place, but it was all off. And then it hit me. This is a monkey brain.
It's that close?
Yes, it's that close to a human brain that when you're looking at a slice of it on an MRI scan, all the anatomical structures are there. It's just in different proportions. You know, so I'm like, is this a kid's brain? I mean, there's something. What disease is this? It's like, oh, wait a minute. This is not a human being. This is a primate. This is a monkey. So it's fascinating. It was awesome to see that. But yeah, it's very, very close. So if you're studying the brain, we like to get as close to humans as possible. So the higher primates are useful. But there's, of course, ethics come in. If you have to, you know, sacrifice the animal and slice up their brain, you can't use chimpanzees. Got to go a little bit farther down the evolutionary, you know, scale from to monkeys, you know, but get as close as you can. If you're looking at just biochemistry, there's this concept in evolution of things being conserved. You know, how long do they survive within evolutionary history? There are some proteins that we share with peas, you know, that are very highly conserved. There are other things that we share with all vertebrates, and there are other things that we share with all primates or other mammals or whatever. So it depends on what we're talking about. If it's something that's generally conserved within mammals, then pretty much any mammal could be a good model for humans. If it's something that's highly variable, that's really specific to primates, then we need another primate. So this is where knowledge of evolution and evolutionary relationships comes in. They are critical to understanding the utility of animal models.
Well, I guess beyond the problems that we've already talked about, and also beyond ethics, because that is an entirely different show, are there other obstacles in using animals in research?
So in terms of their utility to human research, the big obstacle is just, you know, how much of a model are they of the human disease or the physiology that you're looking at. But just as a technology, animals are variable. They could respond to lots of things in their environment. So they could, if you don't know what you're doing, you could inadvertently introduce variables into your research that you may not be aware of.
Like, for example,
if you put animals in cages and then test their response to stuff, they may not be behaving as they. You may be putting them under stress by crowding them in cages. This
right.
is sort of idea, just to give you an example. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, well, how come my mice are not doing well? You know, even the ones that are getting the drug or not getting the drug or the placebo or getting the disease. It's like, well, maybe they're all doing poorly because they're all under stress because of the conditions that they're living in for this study. So just things like that. But then it gets more complicated, too, in terms of the kind of food that you're giving them and, you know, are they being exposed to other animals and, you know, the environmental conditions of the laboratory. So, but the technology of using animals in research is mature. It's a very mature technology. So a lot of these things have been worked out. But that's just, then it's a matter of, is the researcher well-trained and experienced in the technology of doing animal research? People who aren't well-trained or experienced can certainly do crappy animal research because they don't know that all these variables that they have to control for and take into consideration, they can easily introduce artifacts into their research. And unfortunately, that's the case. I mean, you know, it's the researchers, like many things that are very, very rarefied like this, most of your real training is like a mentorship, you know. You don't necessarily take a class on doing animal research. You learn at the feet of somebody who's been doing research, who's old, you know, senior to you. And if so you're very dependent upon the quality of the teachers that you have, the mentors that you have, and how much time they spend with you in really teaching you how to do good research. So there's a great variability out there in the real world in terms of how good different researchers are. So which means there's some really good animal research and there's some really crappy animal research out there.
Well, is there any way to avoid using animals altogether?
Not at this point. I mean, it's clearly you know, there are those who say yes, and there are animal rights activists who would argue that animal models are imperfect or misleading and we shouldn't be using them. We could use other models, but that's not the consensus of opinion. The animal models are massively useful. Again, as long as you understand the technology and the limitations, they're incredibly useful. You know, we certainly hope that the day will come when we can use computer models to minimize animal research. I don't know that we can eliminate it. And you know, the technology advances on using cell cultures. That's typically the process that we follow. We do computer model type of research, what should happen, or maybe it's just all theoretical. And then you maybe do some cell culture research, what happens to cells in a petri dish when I drop the drug on them. And then you go to animal research, and then to human research. Sort of each one is a stepping stone to the next level. So I don't know that for the foreseeable future, we're going to be removing the animal research from that sequence of events, but we can try to minimize it by making the pre-animal research more robust and more predictive so that we can avoid, just like we want to avoid doing unnecessary research in humans, we want to avoid doing unnecessary research in animals. And I'll have to say there's already a huge motivation to do this. Again, even if you put the ethics aside, animal research is expensive and time-consuming and resource-intensive. And so it's, you know, researchers have a huge practical motivation to be very efficient in their use of animals in research. They're not just willy-nilly wasting animals, you know, because it's cheap or easy. It's not. It's very difficult and expensive. So if you could run a computer simulation instead of running trials on animals, believe me, they'd be doing it. The other thing is you have to understand is the reason why biological models are very complicated models. The reason we're doing the research is because we don't understand everything about all the complexities and nuances of those models. So that's why we couldn't, almost by definition, computer model them, right? Because you don't know what you don't know. We wouldn't know what was flawed or what was missing from the computer model. We learn that when we study things in animals and we realize, oh, this downstream metabolite of this thing is having this interaction no one could have ever possibly conceived of ahead of time. But you learn that kind of stuff when you experiment on animals because now you're looking at it in an actual biological system.
Steve, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Anytime.
You'll find links to Dr. Steven Novella and science-based medicine on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you might like to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so you can stay up to date on show news. Or perhaps to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically. Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. Our guest coordinator is Rochelle Saunders. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillion is our production assistant. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.